This is London Calling.
If you're a fan of the hit TV show Lost, you'll enjoy this week's guest. It's Dominic Monaghan, who played the part of Charlie on that show. He also played Merry the Hobbit in the Lord of the Rings films. He told me about how he got that part. On the way to the audition, he was assaulted on public transport in London.
So I went in, but because of the role that I was playing in France, I had a skinhead at the time and a little bit of a shiner. Because someone had hit me on the tube because he thought I was a skinhead. It was just, yeah. I was like, I'm just not a skinhead, I just got my hair cut.
More from Dominic Monaghan coming up. I'm Graham Mack. Let's have a look at what's been happening in Britain this week. Well, we're in the grip of election fever. Or are we? No matter what the result of the general election on June the 8th, Britain is going to end up with a rubbish Prime Minister who represents a party of crooks. Napoleon said that the job of a leader is to define reality and give hope. Isn't that what we need right now? Someone who'll tell it like it is and inspire us. But look at the choices we've got. Of the two main parties, one side is wishy-washy and bland, and the other side is even more boring. And the alternatives to the main parties? They're just as vanilla. The people who've put themselves forward as candidates are some of the most boring people in Britain. And they're all promising the same things. Each party has a slightly different version of a message that promises more money for public services without raising taxes. Well, that's impossible. You can't spend less and get more. They're all lying. None of the party leaders have any charisma. And then when they speak, it's obvious that they're shifty as well. And that just makes them even more unlikable. None of these people are defining reality or giving hope. They're distorting reality. And they're all hopeless. Let's check in with Adam.
Graham?
Yes?
How comes there's always a single shoe on the side of a road? Where's the other shoe gone?
Another one of the great mysteries of the world. Why is there always a single shoe? Did somebody lose a shoe? Or did there used to be two shoes there and somebody found a shoe? Maybe there were two shoes there and a one-legged person came along and went, brilliant, a new shoe. Bill Gates hasn't had much to say about this ransomware virus. It's causing havoc around the world right now. In fact, the silence from Bill Gates has been deafening. In Britain, ransomware has caused chaos with our National Health Service. Dozens of NHS trusts were hit by the cyber attack last week. Operations were cancelled. Patients were sent home. It's Bill Gates' company that's to blame for all of this. All of the reported problems are on computers that run Windows. Windows is a Microsoft product, his company. There's no reports of the ransomware virus showing up on computers running other operating systems like Apple OS or Linux or Google Chrome. Clearly, Microsoft Windows is not fit for purpose. This isn't the first time there's been a global cyber attack on Windows computers. Microsoft Windows doesn't have a great track record of keeping you safe from this kind of attack. In fact, using Windows makes you so vulnerable that to use it, you also have to pay for antivirus software. If any other product had a fault that could cause problems on this scale, it would have been recalled and fixed by now. Customers would have been able to claim compensation. Bill Gates can afford to do all this, but he hasn't even said sorry. Don't get me wrong. Bill Gates is doing a lot of good things in the world. His foundation is spending a lot of money fighting malaria. But this is how crazy the world is now. The National Health Service, who know all about fighting infections in people, are busy right now fighting an infection in computers. And Bill Gates, who knows all about fighting infections in computers, is busy fighting an infection in people. News from Canada this week has had people in Britain talking. It's about a house that was for sale that contained hundreds of clowns. Yeah, statues of clowns and paintings of clowns and mirrors with clowns on. It's always awkward when you move into a new place and the stuff there left behind from the people who used to live there. Ken in Stevenage, this happened to you.
Well, it's a little bit raunchy, actually. We moved into a house in Shells Manor in Stevenage.
Yeah.
And the loft was full of junk.
Right.
Including hundreds and hundreds of Polaroids, pictures of his ex-wife.
No.
Yes.
And how explicit were these pictures?
Very, very explicit.
Oh, dear. And was she the kind of person that you didn't mind seeing naked, or was it good naked or bad naked?
Quite attractive.
Oh, really?
Right. A big smile.
Okay. So what did you do with all these pictures?
I shredded them.
You shredded them. Well, what good for you? You didn't...
We did contact the estate agent.
Yeah.
And he said, look, there's loads of stuff here. Can they come and collect it?
Mm.
They never turned up, so we dumped it all and shredded things.
Jeez. Well, but what an education along the way.
Certainly was.
You should be claiming compensation from Microsoft. They're the ones to blame for the latest cyber attack. But they're still getting away with it. And they're busy blame-storming to shift the blame. The latest scapegoat is North Korea. That'd be handy. Nobody likes them. But the truth is, there's no evidence that puts them in the frame. Russia has also been accused, but there's nothing linking them either. It's really easy to see who's to blame. It's the same people who are responsible for every cyber attack. It's Microsoft. Their Windows operating system isn't up to the job of keeping your information safe. We never hear of cyber attacks on Apple OS, Linux, or Google Chrome. It's always Microsoft Windows. I used to have problems with Windows-based computers, but now I don't own any. I switched. For the last 3 years, all of my computers at home are Apple or Google Chrome. I haven't had a single problem in that time. The only problems I have with computers happen here at work, because here at work we use Microsoft Windows. And what have Microsoft had to say about this latest failure of their operating system? Well, Microsoft's president, Brad Smith, said, here's a quote, "The governments of the world should treat this attack as a wake-up call. They need to take a different approach and adhere in cyberspace to the same rules applied to weapons in the physical world." The cheek of this bloke. he's now blaming the governments of the world for the problem that his company caused. Microsoft also said that they released a patch in March that would protect you from the attack if you'd installed it. So as well as blaming the Russians, the North Koreans, every country's government, you, the Microsoft paying customer, you are being blamed as well. The media aren't helping. They're not reporting the news properly. They're not reporting that only computers using Microsoft Windows get attacked in every one of these cyber attacks. That should be the top line of the story. It should be, computers using Microsoft Windows have been attacked again. Because that's what happened with this latest attack. It was only computers using the Microsoft Windows operating system. Microsoft Windows is a playground for cyber criminals. It was created by Microsoft. Everyone who's been a victim of a cyber attack should sue them. They've got the money. Their crappy operating system has made Bill Gates one of the richest men in the world. He's laughing all the way to the bank while you suffer and Microsoft blames you. Microsoft should change the name of its operating system. It should really be called Dirty Windows or Broken Windows. By now, it should be Curtains for Windows. One of the problems we have on British roads is cyclists. These people take these devices, which are not much more than a child's toy, onto main roads, where the speed limit is 70 miles an hour. They try and compete with buses and trucks and fast cars. Over 100 of them are killed every year and thousands of them are injured. And some of them dress up like sportsmen, you know, with the lycra and the helmets. Now, cycling is a fabulous sport, but it belongs on a track or in a velodrome. Even big races like the Tour de France, they close the roads, because it's dangerous to ride on a public highway. But these people continue to do it and then keep blaming car drivers when they get hurt. Ian's on the phone.
The whole cycling thing.
Yeah, they're a nightmare.
Well, you've set back the safety of cyclists on the road who aren't all sports, who aren't all dressed as sportsmen, as you well know. There's plenty of people that use bikes to get to work. And plenty of other things. You've just set back the whole cycling safety course by about 20 years, mate.
I think what you'll find is I'm advocating cycling safety, because cycling is the most dangerous thing you can do on the road, and I'm trying to save lives. If you're advocating cycling, then you're the one that's asking people to be unsafe. It's an unsafe thing to do on the road.
How are people supposed to get to work?
They can get to work in lots of ways as long as they don't cycle. There's lots of ways for people to get to work. Cycling isn't the only way.
You're putting people in danger.
No, I'm not. You're putting people in danger by asking them to do a dangerous thing on the road, and I'm saying they should stop them.
I'm not asking anybody to do anything.
Do you think people should be allowed to cycle a push bike on a road where there's a speed limit of 60 miles an hour? Well, why? It's the most. Hundreds of people are killed every year by doing this. They should stop doing it.
Who are they killed by, Graham? By drivers.
Yeah, but the drivers. For years, cyclists have been saying it's the driver's fault. And how's that working out for them? It hasn't fixed it. Drivers are always going to hit cyclists because it's a dangerous thing to do on the road.
Drivers are always going to hit cyclists because cyclists aren't respected in this country.
Well, but they've been asking for respect for 50 years and it hasn't worked. So why, if you keep doing something that you always do, you'll keep getting something that you always get. It's time to give up and say cycling is dangerous.
Someone on a low income who has to travel to get to work, how are they supposed to get to work?
Well, then that's a problem that they have to solve, but they shouldn't be risking their life on a push bike to get to work. That's crazy. Are you saying that that we should only... The poor people are being killed? What are you trying to do? Get rid of poor people by having them killed on the road?
I'm not talking to you anymore. You're an idiot.
What they should do is build cycle tracks off the roads so that people can ride their bikes safely. Riding a bike on the road is too dangerous. They need to stop it.
Cyclists are people. They're husbands, fathers, brothers.
Yes, and I want to save their lives, and you won't let me do that. And it will save their lives.
I'm not stopping you from saving anybody's life, Graham. You're putting people in danger the way you're going about it. I don't disagree with all of what you're saying, but the way you're going about it has set back cycle safety about 20 years in this area.
Cycling safety has not worked. The current system, how's that worked out for you? Hasn't worked. Time to ban it. Oh, he's hung up on me. As far as acting goes, David Beckham is a great footballer. He makes a cameo appearance in Guy Ritchie's new film, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. Beckham's performance has been described as cringeworthy. In the film, he plays a disgruntled Cockney knight called Trigger. I'm not making this up. And in his scene, he offers a few words of advice as Arthur attempts to pull the legendary sword from the stone. Arthur's line is, "Where do you want me?" Beckham replies with this.
"Bouncing on my knee. Where do you think I want you? Hands on the hilt, stupid."
I don't think Posh Spice needs to worry about what she'll wear at the Oscars. It's an important scene, that. And David speaks the final words before King Arthur pulls the sword out of the stone. Unfortunately, David Beckham is acted off the screen by the stone. I'm Graham Mack, just having a look at what happened on this day in history. Come back in time with me now. It was on this day in 1883 that the first Wild West show was presented in Omaha by William Cody. He was better known as Buffalo Bill. When I worked on a radio station in Australia, there was a bloke who could have won tickets to a rodeo if he'd known who Buffalo Bill was. The call with me and Phil, this bloke with no knowledge of Bill, became something that listeners used to request.
Banger!
Yeah!
Listen! It's Peter from Tumby.
Nice to talk to you, Peter. What can I do for you?
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, listen, how hard is it? Have you still got all of that Buffalo Bill thing with that bike? I've been telling my missus about that, mate. I'm telling you. I thought that was the funniest thing.
Do you want to hear it again?
Can you get all of it or what?
Yeah, I can get it straight on.
Can you?
Yeah, do you want to hear it again?
Oh, mate. For Peter and Monique.
All right, well, people requesting phone calls now. Anyway, a bit of background now. Now, to win a family pass to the Terminator's Rodeo, he had to answer my question. His name is Phil. He works at the servo at Yamina.
Huh?
And the answer he's looking for is Buffalo Bill.
Mm-hmm.
William Cody was a scout for the cavalry. What was his nickname?
I got no idea.
Okay, let me help you. Let's see. Think of an animal, a Wild West kind of animal.
Wild West kind of animal?
Yeah.
Horse?
No, try again. What's a nickname for William?
William, Bill.
Right, you're halfway there. William Cody was a scout for the cavalry. What was his nickname?
Billy.
No.
Billy Goat.
No, way too much information. Shorten the word Billy.
Goat.
No, shorten the word Billy. What do the phone companies send you every month or whatever?
Bloody Bill.
Right, you've got half the word. Bill. William Cody was a scout for the cavalry. What was his nickname? Think of an animal. Think of a Wild West animal. Show me a home where the... Show me a home where the... Show me a home where the...
Sell me a home where the...
No, show me a home where the... What's that word? When you're naked, what are you in?
Sorry? When you're naked?
Yeah, you're in the...
In the nude.
In the... Yeah, or in the...
Nick?
In the... Another one.
Raw.
In the... Another one. In the... Another one. Come on. Big animal. Like a bison.
Hippo.
No. Wild West.
Wild West.
You can eat their wings at the Hog's Breath Cafe.
Hawks?
No.
Cow.
Close.
Bull.
Nearly. Think of a Wild West. What would the Red Indians eat? Show me a home where the... What is that animal?
I'm trying.
Show me a home where the... Roam.
Where the room?
No. Show me a home where the... Something Rome.
I give up.
No, you can't give up. You've got to win it. You're so close. It's Somebody Bill.
Somebody Bill.
You've already got Bill. William Cody was a scout for the cavalry. What was his nickname? Is it named after an animal?
I've got to serve a customer now.
A big animal.
A big animal. Elephant.
No, an animal in the Wild West.
I've got a couple of cars out in this driveway.
Somebody, Bill.
Bill. I've said goat, haven't I? Billy Goat.
No, it's not Bill somebody, it's Somebody Bill.
Camel?
Camel Bill is not a famous person. Especially not in the Wild West.
I haven't heard of it, otherwise I would have told you the answer, wouldn't I?
Come on, you must have heard of this bloke. He had a little beard, he looked like Colonel Sanders.
Bill.
He had a Wild West show.
Wild West show. What type of show? What show?
A Wild West show.
Any one of them?
No, what? Yeah.
I got a customer here.
Big animal.
Big animal.
Yeah, in the... When you're in the nude, you're in the... In the... A great big animal, like a bison. What else is there? Like a bison. Opposite of high.
Meat.
Opposite of high.
What was in a pie? Meat.
Opposite of high.
Opposite of pie?
No, nothing to do with pies. Opposite of high. What's the opposite of the word high?
High, low.
Right, you've got half the word now. Low. Something a low.
No, I'm still stuck
in. If you're in the nude, you're in the what?
Hang on.
Put the customer on, they better know it.
This is Ray Mick from 2GO. It is. He wants me to put a customer on.
Hey, how are you going there? Hello there.
Hello.
Hello there. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
All right. William Cody was a scout for the cavalry in the Wild West. What was his nickname?
I couldn't tell you.
No, well, it was something Bill. Can you think of a Wild West character? Somebody Bill.
Buffalo Bill.
Yes! At last! What's your name?
Wally Chamberlain.
Oh, well, Wally, tell Phil he's a loser.
All right.
Just tell him he's a loser.
You're a loser.
And Wally, you have won a family pass to go to the Terminators Rodeo next weekend. Congratulations.
Yeah?
Yes.
All right.
Should fidget spinners be banned? Fidget spinners are the big craze sweeping Britain right now. All the kids have them. They're a star-shaped thing about 3 inches across with a bearing in the middle that lets them spin. Seriously, that's it. That's all they are. In this high-tech world of pocket-sized gadgets with more computing power than put man on the moon, the must-have gadget right now for kids is something that's not much more complicated than a spinning top. Schools are banning them, of course, because they're cool. That's not helping. Everyone knows, if the school bans something, you make it even cooler. The schools say the kids are playing with these fidget spinners instead of concentrating on lessons. Well, I'm sorry. If a teacher's so boring that the kids aren't paying attention, you're a boring teacher. Don't blame the fidget spinners or the kids. In the classroom, the fidget spinners are harmless. It's outside the classroom they need to worry. I was behind a BMW on the motorway on the weekend. It was a convertible. The top was down. The kid in the passenger seat was holding the fidget spinner above the windscreen so it spun round in the air. Next minute, he lets go and it heads straight for my windscreen. It only missed me by millimetres. Never mind schools banning fidget spinners from the classroom. How about parents banning them from convertibles? Hey, when you're looking for a new place to live, what's a deal breaker? A survey came out in Britain this week from Mumsnet. And according to their results, unless a place has at least two toilets, people are not interested. Also on the list were things like slow internet. Piper, when you were house hunting, what was a deal breaker for you?
I went round to look at some places with a friend of mine. He was looking in Romford.
Yeah.
We looked around this probate house. So an old gentleman lived there, had died.
Yeah.
We went into the bedroom, and obviously this elderly gentleman quite poorly. So what had they done? They'd built a toilet in the middle of the bedroom.
In the middle?
Yeah, just in the middle of the carpet.
Yeah.
They hadn't covered, you know, tried to box it in or anything like that.
It's just a car.
So my okay. So my deal breaker is,
yeah,
I want a house with a toilet in the middle of the floor.
Piper, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Jim from Philadelphia is on Skype. How are things with you?
Not too shabby.
Mm?
What's on your side of the pond?
Well, I got an email this morning saying I'm a finalist in the New York Festival's International Radio Awards as Best Personality Local Market.
Wow.
That's pretty good. Yeah. I've won a...
That's quite a coup.
Well, I've won that award in 2013. I won that very award, but I won the bronze. So I've got to do... So I'm a finalist, but now we're into the finalist round. So I'm at least going to be a finalist, which is a certificate, and then they can upgrade that to bronze, silver, or gold based on the second round of judging. So I'll be happy. I'm happy being a finalist. It's good. I'll be happy with a bronze, silver, or a gold. But really, I got a bronze last time. It's got to be silver or above this time, hasn't it? Is this the same category?
Yeah.
It's the same category. And also, certificate, you get a certificate on a plank, mounted on a plank of wood. Not that big a deal. But this bronze, silver, and gold, you get an enormous trophy. I've got the bronze.
Yeah, you
want
the hardware.
Yeah, it's a huge, it's like a giant old-fashioned microphone. It's got to be 15 inches high, maybe.
Wow.
Yeah, oh, it's big. It's a big, big old, it's probably taller than an Oscar. It's a good-looking award. It's probably the best-looking award you can win in radio as far as piece of hardware is concerned.
Like an old ribbon mic?
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, you know the nice one, you know the big round... The ring with the springs holding the thing in the middle. You know what I mean? Looks like that. If you go on New York Festival, I think if you go on my site, macmedia.co.uk, there's a picture of the bronze one I won, the actual one I won. Either on the opening page or on the McNuggets page. It's over on the left-hand side. MACK Media.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Now, that
That's
about 15 inches high. That's the bronze one there. That's what when I won it last time.
Yeah, that's a good-looking award.
Great-looking award. Yeah. It's such a shame because the first year I entered, I won a certificate for Best Talk Show Host. And I went to New York and picked up the award and gave an acceptance speech and whatever. And it was on a plank of wood. And other people there were there with these trophies. And I was like, they had this area afterwards where you go and you get your photograph taken with holding your award.
Mm.
And I decided not to go because everyone else would have been holding a trophy and I'm holding a plank of wood.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought there and then, no, I'll be back to pick up a trophy. And when I pick up an actual trophy, and it doesn't even matter if it's bronze, silver or gold. It doesn't have to be gold, just an actual trophy. I mean, you've seen how good looking they are compared to a plank of wood.
Yes.
So I said to myself, no, I'll be back to pick up a trophy. So the next year, I won the bronze trophy. But I'd lost my gig because the curse of awards is usually after you win an award, you get fired because, you know, management get jealous and fire you. And that is exactly what happened that year. The radio station, they fired me. And so I was actually in between jobs. I was picking up freelance work here and there, but I didn't have a permanent job. And I couldn't justify the return trip to New York because you just don't know where the next paycheck's coming from.
Yeah, yeah.
And I couldn't go, which is a good omen for this time, actually, because I'm going to be in New York on the 2nd of June for the Talkers Convention. I can't justify going back to New York on the 19th. So it's another, there's a good chance. You know, if I only win trophies on the years I can't physically go to pick them up. It's extremely unlikely if it's upgraded to trophy level that I'll be able to go. You know, you can't do two trips to New York in 1 month. That's just transatlantic. That's just silly. And especially with Julie looking for somewhere to buy at the moment, you know, we should be hoarding cash, not blowing it on transatlantic trips twice in a month
to New York
just to have my photograph taken with a bloody trophy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'd never get that past her. You know, I'd never be, look, can I go back? What for? Well, I've got to try. I want a photograph of me holding the trophy at the awards. Is that it? That's why you want to go back? There's no way. You know, they send you the trophy. You still get the thing. They post it to you. You know, she'd be like, you know, put a suit on, I'll take your picture holding the trophy.
Yeah, yeah. Go stand in front of a green screen with a suit and we'll Photoshop it in.
Yes, of you at the awards. So I think that's a good sign that this year is a year I probably can't go. Maybe it's the year I get another trophy and hopefully a bit better than bronze. Silver would be, you know, at least I'm making progress.
Yeah.
Because I haven't won anything since 2013. That was the last award I won in radio. So I've been slacking off for a bit. I'm due for one.
But at least you've kept it. You've had a job.
Yes, there is that too. But obviously, obviously, if I get the trophy, there is that downside as well. I will be fired.
Yeah, I'm quite chuffed that I don't work in radio.
Yeah. From the people I've met who work as American broadcasters, it's even more cutthroat there than it is here. There are some outstanding talents. Jonathan Brandmeier, Gene and Julie Gates, Gene and Julie. Outstanding, world-class broadcasters. Both of those examples out of work right now. Cannot get a job on American radio. Gene and Julie have won Both of them have won Marconi Awards. Gene and Julie won the Marconi Award, which is the biggest award in radio you can win in the US. Gene and Julie won one. Jonathan Brandmeier has won a few of them. Both of them out of work. Radio is brutal. Radio is hell, but it's a dry heat. Let's get to this week's guest. You've seen him in the Lord of the Rings films. You've seen him in Lost. And right now, I can see him from Los Angeles on video Skype. It's Dominic Monaghan. You all right?
I'm just out of my shower, so my hair's doing the crazy dent.
It's all right. We don't use the video section. We only use the audio.
It's just for my own personal pride.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do it, man.
So I just watched Atomica. It's set in the future, but is it fair to say that it's more of a thriller than a sci-fi story?
Yeah, I think, excuse me, thriller's a good way to describe it. I kind of call it a paranoid whodunit in the future.
Who are you?
Here to get you back online.
What's this place?
It's the walls, the ground, the air gets in you.
What is that?
Precaution.
Does he seem dangerous to you?
Well, things aren't always what they seem. It's under control.
Tell the truth. Tell her the truth right now.
I'm gonna die.
This thing's bigger than you. The whole world is being lied to.
I think the backdrop of setting it in the future was just helpful as a device to show that, you know, we're at a point where things can really get hectic, you know. I think obviously with what we're currently going through in the news with the United States and Korea and China and Russia, I don't think it's too far away from people's minds that, you know, two or three people make a decision and the rest of the world have to, you know, fasten their seatbelts. But basing it in a contained environment such as an underground bunker, you know, continues to make that fear, that paranoia, that insecurity grow and become larger.
And where did you film it?
We filmed it in a place called Moses Lake, which is in Washington State. So I spent some time exploring Washington State. I went to Seattle for a couple of weekends. Moses Lake was an interesting place. It was a place that at one point obviously fed into this currently working underground base, which was now defunct. So there wasn't a lot going on in Moses Lake. Everything shut at 9:30 at night. So we would be driving back around about 9:30 at night. And if you hadn't eaten, there were no options. You couldn't even, you know, there wasn't even like a late night bar to get, you know, fries or, you know, pasta or a bowl of soup. It was just done, just shut down, you know. So I hadn't been to those places in the United States before. I've been to, obviously I live in Los Angeles. I'd been to Austin, Texas, and New York and San Francisco, and they're all very vibrant cities. You know, the United States is a fantastic country for anything that you might want at any time of day. And Moses Lake was the antithesis of that. It just shut at 9:30, you know, so it was a trip.
Did that help then with the whole feeling of isolation that the film kind of has?
It did, yeah. I see that guitar behind you. My character played a guitar in the film and I brought my guitar up with me, and I really had no other options aside from making sure that my fridge and my cupboards were stocked with things that I could prepare myself, and I would just go home and play the guitar. So I wanted my character to feel alone, to feel isolated, to feel like he didn't have anything. And you know, I think as we're all aware of, if you spend, I think a day is not enough time, but if you spend maybe 2 days, certainly 3 or 4 days on your own, specifically on your own, not doing anything, not talking to anyone, just a kind of a discipline of isolation, it does start to bring some things into your mind that are probably sitting dormant, you know, and I wanted to explore those things when making this movie.
You use the golf club a lot in it. Are you a golfer?
I'm not a golfer, no. You know, I play pitch and putt with my friends, but I'm terrible. I have a very low attention span. So after about 4 or 5 holes, I then start trying to hit trees and hit fences and hit cars and stuff like that. So the reason why we had the golf club and the guitar and some other things which got pushed to the wayside is they wanted the implied threat to be around with Robinson all the time. So he's holding something that could cause damage. So the guitar is obviously an instrument, but it can be used as a weapon. And the same with the golf club. You know, we were juggling things like, you know, maybe he holds a piece of metal, maybe he holds a baseball bat or a walking stick, and those things seemed a little bit too on the nose. So we went for a guitar in the end. And it was fun for me because he's a bit of a wild card, this character Robinson. And I do very much enjoy the guitar. And, you know, the director said, look, as long as you say your lines, you know, you're free to do whatever you want. So a lot of the time I would spend most of the scene just trying to work on a riff that I was working on and remind myself, oh, that's right, there's lines coming up at some point.
So it's the guitar for you. Is that your guitar back there I can see leaning against the wall? Is that
a couple of guitars.
What do you got? What are you playing?
I have in my house, my favorite thing is I play like a small little acoustic Gibson, which is absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
Light and probably 3/4 size. And then I have a Hummingbird, which I don't play that much. I keep it in the case.
It's a nice guitar, the Hummingbird.
Oh, beautiful. Absolutely gorgeous sound. But I leave that for times when I'm not feeling like I'm going to accidentally drop it down the stairs, you know. And then I have a Wilson kind of almost John Lennon on the rooftop concert kind of rip. Remember that guitar that you had?
Yeah, it was a Epiphone Casino, but it was stripped down. It was it was the same Epiphone Casino, by the way, that they used on the 66 tour, except he had it all sanded down and re-lacquered.
Oh, nice. So this is kind of a Wilson version of that, very stripped down, kind of big.
Yeah.
You know, it looks it's almost like a tribute to Eddie Cochran or someone like that.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
Feels kind of school rock and roll. It's great. My brother's a great guitarist and a musician. And, I'm not at that level. I like strumming along to stuff. I like playing pretty simple stuff and singing and spending, you know, 10, 15 minutes a day getting into that thing, you know.
Then maybe you're gonna be the one that saves me.
All of these things that I bring into my life that I'm sure we all bring into our lives, I didn't realize until later on is a way for me to get into a meditative state. You know, playing the guitar feels very meditative. I like gardening. I have a bunch of animals that I work with. And it's all just a way to just kind of slightly turn elements of my brain off while lighting up other ones, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the beginning then. Where were you born?
I was born in Berlin. In Germany, to a teacher father and a nurse mother who had my brother in the Lake District in England. And I think they got itchy feet. They're both from Manchester. They moved up to Kendal and they enjoyed Kendal, but I think they thought, you know, let's go see the world. And they both got the opportunity to go and work in Germany in the mid-1970s. So I was brought up as a Mancunian in a Mancunian household with two Mancunian parents. But in Germany, you know, I was brought up with currywurst and, you know, German ice cream and German people and German summers and German sweets. I mean, like things like German sweets and German bread, I still think is the best in the world, you know. And the German people are lovely. I was very blonde when I was a kid with blue eyes. So just German people just thought, oh, he's just the perfect little Aryan German kid, you know.
What age were you then when you moved to Stockport?
I moved back to Stockport about 10, almost 11. So I had one last year at primary school, St. Winifred's where's St. Winifred's? Heaton Mersey in Stockport. And then went to my secondary school, St. Anne's, on the A6. So
it's all part of Greater Manchester, though, isn't it? For anyone who doesn't know the geography of the area, it's all part of that area. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's all Greater Manchester. I'd moved around schools a lot when I was a kid. I moved to three different schools when I was a kid, and I think that last year at St. Winifred's, when obviously kids had been together for years, and then I came in that last year, I think I had the tools at that point to know what to do. You know, I was all right at football, but I wasn't the best. I was all right at, you know, English and science, but I wasn't the best. But the thing that I could do was, and I think it's helped me in my professional life, is I could be whoever I needed to be for any particular group or person. I knew, like, okay, for the tough guy, I'm going to need to be this. For the girls, I'm going to need to be this, you know. For the guy who I really want to be best friends with, I'm going to need to be this. I'm very adaptable and wasn't intimidated about making new friends. And then we all went the year after to a new school, you know, to a new secondary school. So we all started again. And that little year that I had, I think, really helped me because I didn't have to come into the big secondary school. I got like a little year at St. Winifred's and then moved over.
Would you say you were like adapting characters then? This is something that was a part of you, is that blending in, and that's what acting is, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure. it's one of the facets that I have is adaptability, and I'm pretty quick to read people, and I'm pretty fast at playing the social game, you know, giving people what they need to make them feel more comfortable so they let their guard down, so I get to learn what they actually need, so then I give them more of that. You know, I can do that quite easily and quite quickly. And I was also the clown. I was also the joker. You know, when I was a kid, I mean, I loved acting, and I think I wanted to be an actor by the time I was 8 or 9, but I also wanted to explore being an impressionist because I did impressions of all my school friends, all my teachers, all the Muppets, all the Sesame Street characters, any cartoon character that was popular at the time, you know, footballers, Gazza and Gary Lineker and all those kind of people. And then I realized there wasn't any money in impressionism. No.
Yeah.
It's yeah. True.
Unless
right?
You want to do the Northern clubs, yeah, that's a limited kind of a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Rory Bremner's probably the last great English impressionist, and I'm sure he did well for himself, but and he was superb at what he did, but there really wasn't that much money in it. But I think that impressionism, that adaptability, that chameleon like quality allowed me just to, you know, just slip through any potential problems that would occur, because I wasn't the smallest kid in my year. I was the second smallest, but the smallest kid was so small that he was like magic, you know, like he just extraordinarily small. But I was the second smallest and the lightest and all that kind of stuff, so I was an easy potential target for getting picked on and bullies and stuff. But I was just able to navigate through that very easily because I could see him coming a mile off, and I was like, oh, okay, here's this big tough guy. And he just needs me to have him know that I'm aware that he's tough, and I think that he's funny, and I think that he's smart, and then on we go, you know. So no real problems at school.
You must have got into school plays, though, and stuff, and acting. Was that would have been the first acting you did at school?
Yeah, first real play that I did, apart from, you know, being whatever, I don't even remember, you know, the Christmas tree or the star or one of the wise men in a Christmas nativity. But the first major one that I did was Joseph and His Technicolor Dreamcoat. And I played Joseph when I was 7. And then the teachers took my mum and dad to one side and said, you know, we just want, they told me this later, you know, they said, we just want you to know that, like, you know, he learned the lines immediately. He's asking all the right questions. He wants to do this. He wants to explore this, he wants to, you know, he wants to find out what Joseph did next, he wants to find out what Joseph did before, all those kind of things, which I didn't really realize. I was just playing dress up, you know. And then from there, I remember doing Scrooge at school and really enjoying that. And then I played The Artful Dodger in Oliver, which I very much enjoyed, and was constantly like badgering my teacher, like, let's do 2 plays a year. And I joined a couple of Manchester youth theatres, and no one at my school did drama. No male took drama as an option before me, and I was the first person to do it in my year, and you know, didn't get anything less than an A in drama, which it wasn't necessarily intentional. I just loved it so much, and I was just so enthused with the subject that I don't especially think my teacher liked me that much. You know, I didn't feel like, I don't feel like she liked me. I wasn't her favorite. She had favorites even in my class, let alone in the school. I think she was a little unnerved by me, but she couldn't ever give me any less than an A because I always did the work, you know. And then I joined the Contact Youth Theatre in Manchester, which I just loved. I wasn't there for that long, probably 9 months, something like that, but we did a lot of productions. And then I joined Manchester Youth Theatre, which alongside the National Youth Theatre in London, Manchester Youth Theatre is or was, it's not going on anymore, unfortunately, was one of the most lauded, you know. And I was very, very cocky at the time and had learned all of these Monty Python sketches ad nauseum. And I went in and did this scene from The Travel Agent where Eric Idle, you know, just goes off on this long monologue about why going on holiday is rubbish. And they offered me a part in the group, and in a very cocky, you know, like I'm embarrassed to say it now, but in a very cocky kind of way, I said, I'll join if I can play a major part, but I'm not interested in, you know, yeah, I know it's terrible. I'm so embarrassed. But, you know, I'm not interested in being in the chorus. I'm not interested in being in the line, you know, and they kind of thought, oh, hello, who's this character? And they gave me a good enough part. I mean, it wasn't incredible, but it was good enough. And one of my good friends from Manchester, Johnny Lever, his father is an executive producer for Granada.
The TV, yeah.
Yeah, Granada TV network. And this is pre-internet. So I had asked Johnny, could he ask his dad if he knew of any agents that I could write to? And his father very kindly sent me a printout on a typewriter or something with about 10 different names and addresses of agents in Manchester, in and around Manchester, Rochdale, Bolton, Manchester itself, Stockport, Didsbury. So I just wrote to them, you know, hey, my name's Dominic. I'm doing this play at Manchester Youth Theatre. These are the dates. I'd love if you could come see me. I look forward to hearing from you. Did some truly awful spotlight type photos, you know, quick on the A6, and I was wearing all black. I thought I was in the Beatles. You know? I was wearing all black turtleneck, black jeans, worse hair than I've got going on today, and thought I was the bee's knees. It's just terrible when you think those things. And as far as I know, two of them came to see me, and one of them offered to be my agent. And that was it. I didn't have any other options. So I said, yeah, let's do it. And had then moved from St. Anne's to Aquinas College in Stockport on the just off the A6 again. And I got two auditions. One was for Emmerdale, which was, at the time was Emmerdale Farm.
Yeah. So it was a lunchtime soap at that stage, wasn't it? Was that before it became a nighttime soap? Yeah.
Yeah, it was. It was. And I didn't get it, and I was pretty crestfallen that I didn't get my first ever audition, you know. pretty disappointed calling my agent, but why didn't I get it? Why? And he was just like, look, you look 12 years old and they're looking for someone who's 17, you know. And then the next audition was for Hetty Wainthrop Investigates, which I ended up getting. But what was interesting about that was I went into the waiting room, and almost everyone from Manchester Youth Theatre was in there. Everyone that I'd been working with, you know, which I thought was interesting. And it's a really strange thing happened that I can't really make sense. I still can't really make sense of. But I walked into the room. There's about 10, 12 guys in there. I walked into the room, and a few of them, three or four of them that I'd been in Manchester Youth Theatre with, were like, oh, he's going to get it. And I was like, well, why'd you think that? I've not even been in yet. And they were like, no, you're going to get it. And I didn't understand it. I think I either looked like what they were looking for, or I'm not sure really. They just went, oh, he's going to get that. And I thought, that's interesting. And then I went in and met with them. And they were all taking Polaroid photos at the time. At the end of your audition, they take a little snap of you. And all the photos of the guys were like, you know, just a staunch photo looking at the camera. So when they went to take my photo, I just did this stupid grin, like, you know, just to try and stand out. And I think it helped me jump off the page a little bit. And then three more auditions, and then ended up doing the show for, what, four series.
So you're clearly going towards acting, but your parents are academics. How are they feeling about all this?
Yeah, they were fine with it. They were happy that I was enthusiastic about something, and I think they thought that I enjoyed it and had a great time doing it. You know, my dad obviously would always say, because I studied at college, you know, he would always say, like, you have to concentrate on the other stuff that I was doing, English literature, geography, you know, because you just never know, which I agreed with. But once I got the opportunity to do a job, you know, I then had a decision to make, which was, you know, do I leave college and try out this thing for 6 months, or do I stay at college and finish my education? And I thought I'd get quite a lot of more friction from my parents, you know, saying, well, you can always go and act, but you should finish your education. But we sat down, we sat down and had dinner. And I think their stance was the exact opposite. You can always go back to college and finish your education, you know, if you go back in 6 months, 9 months, a year, but you might not ever get this opportunity again. So why don't you have a look and see what it's like, and then, you know, make a decision afterwards. So I did that, but I knew, like, as soon as I did it, I knew that was it. You know, I just thought, well, I'm not, the genie's been let out of the bottle at this point. You know, I'm not going to go back to college if the option is this, you know.
If your parents had been uncomfortable with it, though, would you have still gone for it?
I'm not sure, because I do hold my parents in very high regard. I mean, I'm quite forceful about some stuff. I still think I was young enough to probably listen to them more. Not that I don't listen to them now, but, you know, now I tell them things, and if they disagree, I might still do it. Whereas, you know, when I was 17, there's a chance that I might think, well, you know, where else am I going to go? Like, I wasn't paying rent at that point, and, you know, I didn't have any money to speak of, you know. So I'm not sure, but they've never steered me in the wrong direction, my parents. They've always, you know, given me the right advice, and given me tough love when they've needed to, and given me just normal love as well. So I think I probably would have, yeah.
So how did you get to do Lord of the Rings then?
So Lord of the Rings came about, you know, I was just a jobbing actor. So I did four series of Hetty, did a play in Bolton, did a play in London, did a couple of films for TV, one in Berlin, actually, which was interesting to go back to Berlin years later, working with Martin Sheen and Rutger Hauer, which was a real thrill. You know, Apocalypse Now is my favourite film of all time, so working with Martin Sheen was incredible.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing guy, and he was a lovely guy as well, which was great to hear. And then, you know, it's just a typical thing. I was doing a TV show with John Thor, lovely John Thor, in France. I got a phone call from my agent saying, can you get back to London in the next, you know, few weeks? Because they're basically doing open auditions for Lord of the Rings. Every young actor, male, between the age of 19 and 24, 25, was going in to read for Frodo and, you know, Sam and Merry and Pippin. So I had struck up a relationship with the Hubbards, who are some of the best casting directors, if not the best casting directors out of England, because they came to see a play that I did, which they enjoyed. So I went in to this audition. But because of the role that I was playing in France, I had a skinhead at the time and a little bit of a shiner, because someone had hit me on the tube because he thought I was a skinhead. It's just, yeah. I was like, I'm just not a skinhead. I just got my hair cut.
I'm an actor.
Yeah. I couldn't get away from that particular one, you know. So I went in and they had a kind of a generic read for the Hobbits. So I knew that I wasn't reading for Frodo because they said, look, you know, we're down the road with Frodo. I think at that point they'd met Elijah and they were obviously in talks with Elijah.
Yeah.
But they said, you know, the piece that we have for the Hobbits is when Gandalf knocks on Frodo's door for the first time and he lets him in and they catch up and all that kind of stuff. And I knew Lord of the Rings. I knew it well because my father is a huge fan of the books and we had listened to the radio plays when we were younger and obviously read The Hobbit. And I hadn't at that point read Lord of the Rings. Oh, that's not true. I had read Lord of the Rings, but I hadn't kind of started to explore it in the way that I did when we were doing the actual movies. So I read it and it seemed to go all right. You know, I didn't embarrass myself. At least I didn't feel like. And then went back to France. My agent called me and said, you know, you did well. They might need you to come back to London, or maybe go to Los Angeles if you can afford it, because the director might, you know, want to get the Hobbits together and get the cast together type thing. So I said, okay. And, you know, I didn't have that much money at the time, but he was like, you know, it's an investment in you and it's something that you should consider. So I said, oh, absolutely, I'll consider that. And then I think like a week or so later, he called me and said, now you don't need to go anywhere. They just offered you the part. So,
wow.
Yeah, I had a week left on this thing with John Thor. And then I went back to Manchester, and I think I had a week before I went to New Zealand. So, you know, pack your bags for, you know, it was almost 2 years, and go. And I was 22, almost 23, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was trying to figure out what to put into a suitcase at that point, you know, what was essential, what was needed. Like I said, it was just before internet, really. So
yeah, it's a long way away. My parents emigrated to New Zealand when I was 18 and took the family with us. But when I was 21, they came back to Britain and I stayed there, ended up living there for 7 years. So I was a similar age, maybe just a touch younger, and I was on my own in New Zealand. It was a long way away when there's no internet, no email, and a letter takes a week and then a week to get a reply. Yeah. But it's a fabulous, I found it a fabulous place. I became a New Zealand citizen. I got a New Zealand passport now. So what did you make of New Zealand?
Yeah, I love it. I've been trying to get citizenship for a long time, which, you know, we would all laugh about it, saying, you know, Jesus, we were in Lord of the Rings. You would have thought they'd give us some sort of
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The country made like, you know, $20 billion off of it or something.
More from Dominic Monaghan in 2 weeks' time. Find out how he coped after living in New Zealand for nearly 2 years as a young man and having global success with Lord of the Rings, and then having nothing, being out of work, and how drugs played a part. Dominic Monaghan in 2 weeks' time on London Calling. Next week, it's part two of my chat with Mike Brewer, the South London car dealer who's now an international television presenter. He told me about how he found himself in a war zone, in a helicopter, and coming under fire. That's all happening next week, right here on London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mack. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk. And you can subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. Maybe your Skype details. I might call or Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. You spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week. Ta-da.